Good morning. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Monday, March 19, 2018. The time is 9:02 a.m. I'm Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon. With me this morning is Co-Chairman Hoffman.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Vice Chairman Bishop is out of our room right now and on other state business. Senator Von Imhoff.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Michicki.
Good morning.
Senator Stevens.
Good morning.
Senator Olson is away on other state business. On today's agenda, we have the spring forecast. I'd like to invite Commissioner Sheldon Fisher, as well as Chief Economist Dan Stickle, to the microphone. I'd also like to acknowledge Senator Kathy Giesel. Welcome to Senate Finance. If you're joining us off-net or online, we're in Juneau, Alaska, room 532, the state capitol. Commissioner Fisher, welcome to Senate Finance, if you'd provide us some opening remarks.
Thank you. My name is Sheldon Fisher. I'm the commissioner designee from the Department of Revenue, and I'm here with Dan Stickle, who's our chief economist. And on Friday, we released our spring forecast. We signaled that we would try to do that early, and I'm pleased with the work from the team that accomplished that. And we're prepared to present that now if you're ready.
Please proceed.
Great. So just to put this into perspective, we're continuing the discussion and the series of forecasts that have been produced by the department going back to the fall, well, actually the spring of 17 and then through that period. And we're now in the spring forecast. This is the ordinary course. I think that we've testified to these other forecasts in the past and they're becoming less relevant, but I thought it was helpful just to put this into context. Of course, we have updated both the production and price forecast as well as some other assumptions, and we thought we'd jump into the production forecast first and then talk about price and then pull together some of the other dimensions. This is a slide that we often share that shows kind of a historical perspective of where we're at in terms of production, and as we shared in the fall with our fall forecast, we're seeing a leveling out and flattening of production, which is a positive development for the state and for revenues. Moving now then to the FY18 forecast and the update, what we show here are in the chart below and represented in the graph, but the solid portion of the orange line is the actual production that we've experienced. And currently, we are averaging about 518,000 barrels a day, a little bit over that, against what was our forecast of 533 barrels per day is what we expected out of the year. You can see in the chart below the assumptions for the remaining months of the year, and you can see that we are forecasting that production both in the last quarter and also in the year will be modestly below where it was in fiscal year 17. To put the fourth quarter into a little bit of perspective, typically the fourth quarter represents, and when I say typically, over the last 10 years, the fourth quarter has represented about 24.5% of the year's production, and our assumption is in line with that it would be about 25, a little over 25% of the FY18 actual production.
Commissioner Fisher, if you
yes.
could pause for a moment. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. Through the chair, Commissioner Fisher, with this drop, do you feel that this is could be attributed to a particular field, Prudhoe-Kuparuk, or is this more of like a general decline kind of throughout the whole North Slope?
So first of all, let me say, and you'll see it in the next slide, this does not reflect a long-term decline in our view of production, and you'll see that the long-term production is largely in line and consistent with what we've expected before. There's a couple of dimensions, and I'll let Dan talk to some of the specifics. Overall, the weather has been warmer in this winter, which has resulted in we actually do better when the weather is colder. The equipment operates better, and they're able to accomplish more with colder weather, and so that has been part of it. There's also been a couple of events that have impacted specific properties that have resulted in the decline, and I'll let Dan talk to that a little bit.
Sure. For the record, Dan Stickle, Chief Economist with Department of Revenue, just expounding on what the
what the commissioner said, looking at a unit-by-unit analysis of the forecast versus the previous year, I think Kuparuk production, we're forecasting, is up. Prudhoe Bay is down, and Prudhoe Bay is one that the temperature has a pretty significant impact on. There's also been some issues, some technical issues at some of the other fields like Point Thompson and Alpine that are factored into the forecast here.
Senator Von Imhoff, follow-up?
No, thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Please continue. And we're on slide 5, moving to slide 6.
Thank you, yes. And I'll do a better job of announcing the slides. And so on slide 6, this is then looking at our long-term forecast. And as you can see, FY18, as we've just discussed, it reflects the decline that we anticipate this year. But then looking forward into the other years, you see that we're essentially in line with a modest increase over the fall forecast in terms of what we see as the long-term production. So I'll pause again. We're going to move to the price discussion and changes in our price forecast, but if there are any questions about production.
Senator Pachicki.
Thank you. Commissioner, just if you can explain, the department has a tendency to, instead of splitting the difference between a high case and a low case, you typically lean toward the 33% mark or so, somewhere around there. Can you just explain why that is?
I guess I don't understand the reference to the 33%.
Senator Pachicki.
So if you look at your spring 2018 high case, look at your forecast, and you look at your spring 2018 low case, some other entities predict closer to the midpoint or the mean of that, as opposed to the department who typically predicts in the lower third, if you will.
Okay. Through the chair. First of all, as noted in the footnote there, this production is done primarily through the Department of Natural Resources. They're the ones that produce this production, this forecast. And the cases are intended to be, that mid-case is intended to be what we refer to as a P50. So it's 50% likely that it will be that, and 50% that'll be higher, 50% that'll be lower. And so what you see in this scenario is that the Department of Natural Resources anticipates there's more, in essence, upside opportunity, which is why there's a larger scale to the upside than there is downside risk, which is why there's a narrower band on the downside. And so it's really about the probabilities of different scenarios and what they see as opportunities versus risks in the forecast.
Thank you. Commissioner Fisher, we've seen quite a few of these revenue forecasts here at the Senate Finance Committee table. So if I get the wrong one, I apologize. But in a past one, I think it was the fall 17, it could have been the spring 16. But didn't we see a 12% decline over the next 10 years, which has been changed to more of a flat projection at this point? Or was that further back than I'm thinking that we saw that?
So,
increased decline.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm going to just refer to slide 2 again, and I believe that the late April 17 forecast, the administration did come forward with a 12% decline. We then came through with a fairly soon thereafter a what we referred to as a 4% production decline scenario, which was really not a new forecast, but a scenario that was a reduced decline. And your memory is exactly right that both in the special session as well as in our fall forecast, we've revised those to be flat, essentially, over the period.
Commissioner, the only reason I point that out is that, as Senator Pachicki said, I appreciate the department being conservative in its approach when we present numbers, but it does have an impact for planning purposes on many things that we do. And back in April of 2017, when those numbers were out, I believe Senate Finance pushed back significantly on the numbers on the 12% decline when, in fact, we had seen increases in production and actually completed a second year of increased production. So I appreciate that we're at least at a flat level now, and understanding, and all Alaska should understand, that that number can go up or that number can go down depending on weather, as been cited today, or some reason to shut down the pipe that could cause an interruption in flow at any particular point in time. So I appreciate those numbers. We're on slide 6, moving on to the spring price. It's on 7, so we'll be on slide 8 for those that might be following along at home. This document is available through Senate Finance. It is labeled Spring 2018 Revenue Forecast. It's dated March 19, 2018. Commissioner.
Great. So thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm on slide 8. As you can see, this is the Energy Information Agency, a U.S. government agency that attempts to predict both supply and demand for oil looking forward. And what you see there is that vertical orange line represents the difference between when we're looking at actuals versus a forecast period. And we've been through a period recently where the demand has been greater than the supply, and that is represented by the orange line versus the blue line, and the fact that the green bars are declining, suggesting that actual inventory is shrinking during these periods. The EIA does anticipate in the coming quarters that will change, and we'll begin to see that world production will again exceed consumption. Although the range, candidly, is fairly tight in each direction, and what you'll see as you go forward, and we'll talk a little bit about it, is that EIA is anticipating a period of growing inventories for the coming few quarters, and then that will begin again in this period. You'll see it start to shrink when you get to the far right of the slide. Moving then to slide 9, and this is really thinking about our FY18 forecast to begin with. And the solid black line reflects the actual numbers during the period. And so if you think about it, when we started this current fiscal year in July of 17, the price of oil was just above $50, and it's climbed almost to $70 during the period. The average to date is just over $59 a barrel. We are assuming in nominal dollars that the price of oil will stay above $64 a barrel for the remaining months of the year, and that will result in a forecast price of about $61 a barrel during fiscal year 18. And as you can see, the red line on this chart is the NYMEX futures prices. So this is what, if you wanted to go into the marketplace and buy oil in the future, that red line would reflect the price that you would pay. These are in real dollars on this chart. And you can see that we're largely consistent, slightly above what the NYMEX futures price would predict for the price of oil. There are no questions?
Commissioner, I'm pondering. The revenue forecast actually sets the line for the calculation on credits that are due folks that are owed money from the state of Alaska. Is that threshold right at $60?
A portion of the slide will, portion of the presentation later, will actually go through the credits calculation. $60 is the difference between whether the pool of money that is set aside to pay credits is 10% or 15%. If it's above $60, then it's 10% of the taxes that are the production taxes that are due, and if it's below the line, it's 15%. And so that $60 is the threshold where that delta changes. And we'll walk through later that calculation and how the forecast has changed.
Commissioner, the reason why I ask, because we're in a precarious situation at 59 to 61, right? Correct? And I'm looking at your slide that you said 24.5%, so looking at 25% production, in this year, and so it's an active choice to choose a number. We've stated price a little bit higher. I'm not sure. I didn't look at the price today, but we do think we're going to average over $61 a barrel in the next 3 months.
Yes, our forecast assumes that the oil will stay slightly above $64 a barrel between now and the end of the fiscal year, resulting in an average price for the fiscal year of just of $61.
Thank you very much for bringing it up. Yeah. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I like slide 8, and I think your far right-hand side of the slide is the key heart of the matter. You were correct, Commissioner Fisher, when you said the ranges, as in the height of the green bar, are shorter than the ones you can see in 2015, which is a good thing when supply and demand reach to some degree in equilibrium. But as you can see, they kind of move up and down. When you're doing your research, are you finding that as the price creeps up past 65 or so, that fracking becomes more prevalent, banks start lending again at those prices for frackers? Those seem to be, they're nimble and they're quick, and they can actually have a pretty significant impact on supply. And how confident are you on those green bars?
Well, through the chair, I accept this as one source of data, and I think as we go through our price forecast, excuse me, we'll show you that that there are multiple views and opinions that candidly we don't necessarily try to duplicate the work within the Department of Revenue, but rather to do a broad survey of what different intelligent and thoughtful and organizations that have a lot of resources put behind it. And so one of the things, and we'll go through this as we talk about our price forecast, it really is, I think that the questions, the consensus around demand is more narrow than the consensus around supply. And what I mean by that is that there seems to be a fairly narrow range of what people think the demand, how that demand curve may vary and change. And there's a really fairly substantial range in terms of how people view what the supply of oil will be. And we'll kind of walk through that. We've tried to pick a case that we think is reasonable, and you'll see it and form your own judgment, but there certainly are different scenarios that we'll kind of highlight for you that could change this meaningfully one way or the other.
Thank you. Commissioner, is it fair to say that OPEC trying to control output has helped globally stabilize the price, and in fact the price is moving upwards because they are producing less?
Madam Chair, that's absolutely true. And there was it, periods in the past that were just the opposite, and we are seeing more discipline in from OPEC nations as well as Russia.
Thank you, Commissioner. And so for Alaskans following at home, what's happening in the U.S. market is U.S. market, as Senator Von Imhoff is referring to, is those that can be flexible in where they go and how fast they can drop drills. The fracking is increasing in the U.S., and so we're starting to pull in from OPEC's perspective on a greater percent
yes.
of oil production in the world, and that may or may not please those that are controlling and producing less that right. is benefiting us twofold, both on the price side and the production side. Is that fair?
Madam Chair, it's a very perceptive and interesting comment that you make. And in fact, what you'll see as we go through the different analysts and opinion leaders' discussion is that very dynamic about how does Shell react, how does the OPEC react, and then how do certain countries like Venezuela that may be at risk for some disruption in terms of their supply into the marketplace, how will all of those factors play in will determine where a person believes the price of oil will fall long term. And some people have a certain scenario which leads them to believe the price will be high, and others see the same facts and come to a different scenario that leads them to believe the price will be low. And it's so those factors around supply are largely the difference between the range of forecasts you see out there.
Thank you. And then, Commissioner, finally, Saudi Arabia is going through a similar process that Alaska is going through, in that that output for a high price had benefited the people of Saudi Arabia exponentially. And the low price, like in Alaska, somewhat similar, is producing less revenue available to distribute or invest in communities. And so they're struggling with a similar price production issue. And they are looking, too, at a sovereign wealth fund, as I understand it. Can you give us any additional information on that?
Well, just, Madam Chair, just to reiterate what you've said, yeah, Saudi Arabia has struggled to balance their budget at current pricing, and for a time I think they thought it was in their interest to actually produce more oil to try to bring some discipline through lower prices into the marketplace. I think they've revised on that and recognized that they're harmed when prices drop substantially. I do think that they and other oil-dominant countries are looking at what's happening in the United States and shale oil with a lot of interest. I think the comment was made earlier that that one of the impacts of lower pricing on the shale industry is it's actually become more efficient and more capable of producing oil at ever declining oil prices, which will again continue to impact the supply of oil and how the world kind of responds to different events. And so it's been kind of a new day. There was a time when I think OPEC had more control over the price of oil, but as shale has become more of a swing producer, it's been more difficult for them to control. And our view is that at slightly over $60 a barrel, these various supplies, shale in particular, become economical and there's a meaningful amount of supply at those prices. You'll see as we go through that other people see it slightly differently.
Commissioner, as we go through, will there be a conversation in your presentation about costs? Because you just alluded to that. When things get tough for Americans, Americans step up. And specifically in Alaska, what we've seen in the price forecast is that the producers on our North Slope and in Alaska in general have found a way to lower costs. And so we're seeing the benefit of that by flat production and not a decline, or increased production as we experienced in the last 2 years, and now lower costs actually to extract some of the hydrocarbons on our North Slope. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. And we do have a portion of this presentation that will discuss the cost for Alaska. We don't, and we could prepare something and come back if there's interest. We haven't really pulled a presentation that talks about other regions of the world in terms of their cost structures.
Senator Machicki.
Yes, thank you. Commissioner, I think it's fair to say that even conventional players have brought down their cost of production globally, right? I mean, when oil's $107, $110 a barrel, you just don't have the focus on cost control that you do at $29 or $35 or even $65. So I think everyone's become more efficient. The question I was going to ask, part of that efficiency results in a lower transportation costs and lower lease costs as well. So the only improvement we see on the revenue forecast is not only the price of oil, it's also the reduction in what can be written off. Is that correct as well? And do we cover that in this presentation?
Through the chair, yes, that's correct, and we will go through those facts for Alaskan producers.
Please continue.
So we've covered slide 9, I believe. So moving then to slide 10, this shows, so slide 9 was about FY 18. This is what we would call a short-term forecast. These are real dollars. And again, what you see in the black line, the solid portion of the line is actual. The dotted portion of the line then reflects our forecast. The blue line reflects analyst forecast, and you can see that we're right in line with the analyst forecasts. The green line on the page is the EIA short-term energy outlook, and they produce both a short-term energy outlook that gets updated monthly as well as an annual outlook, and we'll talk about both of those. But I think you can see that we, our price point for the next couple of years is kind of on the higher end of the range of forecasts that are out there. Again, the NYMEX reflects long-term futures prices. Now, in fairness, there's not a lot of volume in the long-term futures as you get out, and I think many people perceive that NYMEX, as you go beyond kind of a year, 18 months, becomes a less reliable predictor of what actual prices will be, but it's there for your information. Moving to slide 11, this then gives you some of these numbers on a more specific numerical, and these are nominal prices, and so you see our forecast grows from $63.19 and kind of grows steadily to about $75, and in fact, it largely stays flat in real terms, and we'll show you that in a moment. NYMEX, we've talked about that. That's slightly below our pricing in the short term. The EIA short-term energy outlook, and I should just say something. If you go to this is an interesting fact. In fact, let me come back to slide 10. If you go to the NYMEX or the EIA short-term energy outlook, and you looked at their prediction for calendar year 18 and calendar year 19, it would say $62 is their forecast for those calendar years. But it just so happens that our fiscal year kind of falls into what they're predicting on a monthly basis, a dip in oil prices. And so if you average their monthly prices over fiscal year 19, that's where you see in slide 11 that they're actually predicting for our fiscal year a $60 price for oil for that period. Interestingly, then, when you look at the EIA's annual energy outlook, this is their annual prediction, and that is a longer-term case, you see that they are much more bullish, I guess you would say, expecting higher prices, and we'll talk a little bit about the assumptions that underlie that. And then you see the analyst average, and the analysts don't go beyond 3 years, essentially, and you can see that they are on average, and we'll go into some examples there as well, that they have a price that is more or less in line with our price. I think they see 20 and 21 a little bit more optimistically, and then starting in 22, they see kind of a decline again down to a nominal dollar, $64, and we'll show a little bit more detail. So if you...
On the EIA long term, do you think that is taking into account China or the Asian market switch over from coal to a hydrocarbon, possibly natural gas?
Well, that certainly is part of it, and they're mindful of that. I think that, and we'll go through some facts, some bullet points on their model, but it's more a view of what's happening on supply. The EIA has a view that the world is underinvesting in oil production, and that the investment will not keep up with demand, and that over time that will result in an imbalance that will drive prices upward.
Commissioner, then to follow up on that, is that reflective of renewable energy or an eye on other energy production versus hydrocarbons that EIA long-term is thinking is going to be in error, and so they're pushing the price up if supply is what?
Well, the renewables will impact the demand, of course, and I think the view is that renewables will be a factor, and electric cars, and there will be a number of those trends that will impact the demand, but I think the view is that demand will continue to grow as economies expand, and there continues to be growing demand for oil from other needs. And as I say, there is different views around demand, but those tend to be more narrow in scope. I think that there seems to be more of a consensus about what will happen on the demand side. Some believe that there'll be more growth. Some believe that there'll be slower growth. Everybody seems to believe that there will be a growing demand for oil. But it's really the difference in these predictions is largely around supply and what different analysts predict will be happening on the supply of oil. And it has to do with OPEC, it has to do with shell oil, and it has to do with disruptions in certain sectors.
Shell, S-H-A-L-E versus S-H-E-E.
Yes, shale.
Thank you. Senator
Michiki. And EIA's considerations are across all of the various probabilities. I mean, they definitely discuss usage and conversion probabilities with generation, transportation, and manufacturing. It's a portion of their evaluation, perhaps more so in the out years, right, on the consideration of renewables and other potential opportunities.
Yeah, through the chair. No, we would agree with that. And I don't, by my statements, I don't intend to imply that these analysts see, you know, don't anticipate an impact from renewables and from some of these other factors that will impact demand. I guess my only comment is there seems to be a more narrow range of variability around assumptions in demand than there are in supply.
Thank you. Please continue.
This shows, I'm on slide 12 now, and this then is focused just on the analysts. This is more short-term because, as we said a moment ago, the analysts don't like to predict beyond a few years forward. And this shows kind of the solid blue line is the average, and then the two dotted lines are the 25% of the highest analyst and the 25 percentile of the lowest analyst. And so just there you see kind of a range on the low side between the 50s and on the high side growing as much to the high 70s before settling kind of in the mid-70s by the end of this forecast period. And you can see that those forecasts result in starting in 2021, a decline in where analysts see the price of oil, and then you can see our prediction is that we see it remaining more flat than declining. To go into a little bit of the details, I'm on slide 3, is what is driving it. As I mentioned just a moment ago, all of the those predicting, even those that are predicting low versus high, all of them are predicting growing demand. So even the analysts that believe that the price will be low still see a growing demand for oil. They just see it growing at a slower rate. On the high side, they see demand growing more rapidly. EIA then has kind of their short-term forecast is a more steady or flat, with their long-term being a moderate demand case. And we'll go through, EIA has a reference case, a high case, and a low case, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But as mentioned a moment ago, the real difference between these analysts is on the supply side, where the analysts that see a low price believe that there will be, I think one of them said, a supply blowout, where there will be strong production both in the U.S. market as well as in OPEC countries. On those that see a high oil price, see the shale oil being more flat because of discipline in the financial markets and access to capital. And then they see disruptions elsewhere in the world, so Venezuela demand and those locations, and that combination will drive a high price in the near term. And then EIA, as mentioned a moment ago, believes they have a long-term thesis that that the world is under-investing in production.
Commissioner, if you could pause there for a moment. I did want to acknowledge Senator Bishop has joined us. Welcome, Senator Bishop. We did tell those that were watching that you were on another task for the state. Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just and I don't need it right now, but I think analysts just generally have become more conservative through the last couple years of unanticipated volatility. Just can you provide us with your portfolio of analysts that go into your analyst average? If, and I don't need it right now, just curious how they've been selected and what that list looks like.
Sure, we'll provide that list. And we can provide the list as well as their forecast, so you've got all that data.
Thank you.
So we just chose a couple of analysts just to give you a sense, and we've taken kind of a high and low and a midpoint. So Guggenheim is forecasting in the 18-19 period that we'll have a price of oil between $70 and $80 a barrel. Their view is that India and China will add about 5.4 million barrels per oil in terms of demand, that electric vehicles will be that the reduction in that demand will be offset by other non-auto consumptions, and that cold weather will increase the demand for oil. On the supply side, they view that OPEC has limited spare capacity, and that shale is particularly effective in adding supply, and that the combination of those that shale production actually will not grow as fast as expected because of CapEx discipline, and then they see in what is kind of already a likely tight market between supply and demand that disruptions in Iran and or Venezuela will kind of push the world market higher deal with that disruption. Going to the other extreme then, a bearish example is Citi. They see that same period of time, 18-19, they anticipate the price will be kind of in the high 50s to the high $49 in 19, and it's largely driven by a blowout of supply. And so the demand assumptions are more or less flat, so they don't necessarily see the increase that Guggenheim saw coming from China and India, and then they see a significant supply coming into the marketplace, particularly driven by U.S. production. And then just to round it out, you've got Deutsche Bank that kind of sees a price fairly comparable to ours, $62 for the next few years. They see kind of modest demand growth supply that is largely able to meet demand. I think they see that there may be some drivers that make it difficult for OPEC to continue to maintain their agreements as they have, and that there may be either a breakdown or production above agreed amounts, as well as a leveling out of production in the U.S. And so they just kind of see a steady state compared to where we are today. Moving then to slide 17. This, we're moving now from a more short-term to a long-term forecast, and so as a result of that, what the analysts kind of start to fall off of the page because they don't tend to predict a long-term price forecast. That green line then is the EIA's reference case, and we'll go into a little bit of detail on that, and then the NYMEX, again, is the futures market forward-looking. On slide 18, then, I referred to this a bit earlier. These are the three EIA forecast cases that are produced. They've got a low case, what they refer to as a reference case, and then a high case. And you can see that they have a wide range between them. In the out years, from the low of about $30 to a high of $140, and so there's a very wide discrepancy. And if you then look at on 19, kind of the difference between these cases, on the demand side, the reference case is moderate demand, where the low case is a slowing global demand and a high case is a growing global demand. But again, the larger question is what will happen with supply. And so in the low case, they see higher OPEC production, they see lower cost for non-OPEC exploration that's largely in the United States, and as a result of that, then there's a lower price in the marketplace is adequate to bring the supply necessary to meet demand. The reference case, OPEC production is flat. The U.S. comes in with as the largest contributor for non-OPEC oil, but requires a somewhat, at least compared to their high case, a in price increase in order to be able to meet the supply or the demand requirements. And then in the high case, they see a scenario where OPEC production is falling, costs are growing substantially higher for non-OPEC development, and therefore they see a larger or a higher price is necessary for the market to balance. Just a couple more slides on the price. These colored lines across represent our fall from the fall forecast event that we had. If you recall, we came up with these P10 to P90 scenarios, and the dotted black line then is our current spring forecast. And what you see there is that in the near term, we're materially higher than what we predicted in the fall. But in the long term, we continue to believe that oil in the $75 range in 2028 will be what the market is at. And to view that in real terms, the dotted line is our fall forecast in real terms. The dashed line is our spring forecast. And so what you're seeing is that we continue to have a long-term view that in real terms, oil in the $63 range works for the world economy, that there's enough production to meet demand. In real terms, we just get there faster than we expected to in the fall. I'm now on slide 22, and this then takes, these are the same numbers we showed you before. It's a set of alternative sensitivities for your consideration. And so under each forecast then is the UGF associated with that forecast. And I won't go through all the numbers, but I think it gives the legislature and others who are listening a perspective on what if prices, the scenario looks like one of these alternative cases, and you can see the revenue impact associated with that. So if there aren't any other questions on the price, we will move to the cost forecast. And for that, I will turn it over to Mr. Stickel.
Sure. Again, for the record, Dan Stickel, Chief Economist with Department of Revenue. So slide 24 shows our North Slope capital expenditure forecast for the spring forecast compared to the fall forecast. This kind of gets at some of the comments that were made earlier in the presentation about cost reductions in the oil patch. We have reduced the capital expenditure forecast for the next several years compared to what we were seeing in the fall. There's two big pieces of this. One is continued cost reductions by the producers on the slope. Not necessarily a reduction in activity by the producers, but they've been able to bring down costs and get concessions out of some of the service providers and things like that. There's also been some delays in projects by the non-producers. We've seen very little activity by non-producers this winter compared to what we were expecting. One major example is at the PICA unit, it was actually announced that they've canceled their drilling program for next winter as well. So that's somewhat of a delay. We are still forecasting, though, that activity will start to pick back up in 19 and beyond. So you do see that increase in capital expenditures foreseen there, primarily in some of the newer units. And then slide 25 is the same picture for operating expenditures. You see again for 18 and 19 a slight reduction. That's primarily due to some of the cost reductions at the existing units. Beyond FY19, largely consistent with our previous forecast. And then once you get out into 2023, you see an increase in the operating expenditures from a little under $3 billion a year to about $3.5 billion a year. What's happening there is that's when we're seeing some of the new fields come online, PICA, Placer, Mustang, Moose's Tooth, fields like that. So once those fields come online, there will be an increase in operating expenditures for producing those fields. Slide 26 is probably the biggest change that we've made on the cost forecast from the fall forecast. We had a settlement announced for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System that effectively reduced tariff rates by about $1 a barrel across the board. So you see that FY18 tariff forecast includes a half year of that change, and then from 19 and beyond, we've reduced our transportation cost assumptions by about $1 a barrel. Just for reference, for FY19 alone, this transportation cost change resulted in about $46 million increase to the revenue forecast versus what it would have been under the old tariff cost forecast.
Mr. Sickle, I have a question. Could you refresh me and the people of Alaska, who is the developer of the PICA project?
Madam Chair, the operator was Armstrong. My understanding is that the operatorship is transferring to Oil Search sometime this month.
Mr. Stickler, are the failure of the state to be able to pay the tax credits possibly impacting that operator?
Madam Chair, you saw that there's in this most recent fiscal year, we've seen very little activity by the non-producers, and I think it would be reasonable to assume that the lack of tax credit payments has something to do with that.
Thank you.
So if there's no other questions on costs, speaking of tax credits, moving on to slide 28, we've received some questions about the statutory appropriation and how we calculate that statutory appropriation and why, and that was the impetus for this slide. AS 4355.028 is the section of the production tax statutes that references tax credits. So 4355 broadly is the section of tax statutes that refer to production taxes, and then there's several subsections within 4355. But the tax credit guidance mentions either 10 or 15% of taxes levied by AS4355.011 for the statutory appropriation. And when our price forecast is $60 or greater, it's 10% of those taxes under 011. And when our price forecast is below 60, it's 15% of those taxes under 011. So our interpretation has been, when we were first looking at this a few years ago, 011 lays out the production tax calculation itself, which is either the minimum tax or the 35% net profits tax, and then other subsections of statute, in particular 023, 024, and 025, lay out the different credits. So our interpretation was to calculate the statutory appropriation based on the production tax before credits in 011, because there are no credits out of 011. And we have provided this for several years now. Beginning in 2015, we provided this to the legislature and the administration. We've published our statutory appropriation in the Revenue Sources Book, beginning with the fall 2016, and beginning with the 2017 budget proposal. It was incorporated into the governor's budget. There's been some question as to whether the appropriation should be based on tax before or after credits. Our understanding is there's a legislative legal opinion that states that the statutory guidance itself is ambiguous and precedent, and we think best practice favor interpreting such an ambiguous statute in the benefit of the taxpayer.
Mr. Stickle, thank you for those comments. Your current calculation is consistent with past calculations, is that correct? And so to put on the record, at least from myself, I can't speak for my committee, but I will be supporting the accepted practice that we have been using versus recalculating a percentage based on a new interpretation. So I understand that that new interpretation could be valid. But for me, it would need to be introduced in a piece of statute, otherwise by a bill, to actually accept the new calculation versus trying to rewrite it on the fly from at least my perspective. Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Mr. Stickle. Just wondering, is this the administration's consistent opinion that the tax would be calculated before credits?
Madam Chair, or through the Chair, maybe I'll respond to that. Yes, I mean, I think that the administration has consistently taken this position. I think that until this year, this has been the way the legislature has talked about this. And certainly the governor's proposed tax credit legislation that we propose to bond in order to pay those tax credits off is based on this assumption. The governor's budget is based on this assumption. And so I think that we believe that the right thing to do is to maintain the current interpretation, both because we think it's right to begin with. Secondly, we believe that it has been relied upon by industry and will be the least disruptive to industry to continue to maintain that interpretation.
Follow-up, Senator Machicki.
Can I assume there's a significant amount of weight based on the court precedent of interpreting ambiguous tax statute in favor of the taxpayer in the past as well? Is that correct?
That's correct, and it's also there's some deference also given to the department that is assigned to interpret that statute, and so both of those, I think, weigh in favor of maintaining the status quo.
And for clarity for my grandson, who sometimes is watching, and I know he's young, but we're a bicameral legislature, and the other body's finance committee has drafted a new interpretation of the number that we should now pay for tax credits, which is creating instability and uncertainty in an industry that's revenue affects Alaska greatly. And so I understand not wanting to pay our bills. I just don't support not paying what we owe. Commissioner.
Sure. And to continue again, Dan Stickle for the record. So slide 29 shows an illustration of how we arrive at our statutory appropriation calculation. For fiscal year 19, we are estimating the appropriation at $184 million. That consists primarily of North Slope production. also includes some calculation for Cook Inlet and private landowner royalties. So this slide here just shows the calculation for that North Slope oil portion of the statutory appropriation. And as you can see here, we are forecasting a per barrel tax of about $1.65 billion at the 35% tax rate. Now that's before application of the per barrel credits, but that gets you about $165 million at the 10% rate for the FY19 appropriation. Again, with Cook Inlet and some other smaller pieces added, that gets to $184 million total.
Mr. Stickel, just thinking about the comments, I just want to put on the record, are any of the credits going to the big three companies when we talk about credits that haven't been paid, which goes back to my question earlier on the PICA project and the state not living up to at least past obligations of planned payment history?
Sure. Madam Chair, the credit statutes state that only companies with less than 50,000 barrels of oil equivalent per day production qualify for state purchase of credits. So the big three would not qualify.
Thank you. Just for Alaskans listening at home, the reason why, at least from my perspective, the Senate is stuck on this particular conversation is because the investment in paying our obligations actually increases production. And while we watch some projects languish, they don't have the capital to move forward right now that they had anticipated based on Alaska's previous ability to be able to pay 100% of a tax obligation, a tax credit obligation in a given year, and then we fell back to the statutory interpretation, which I think in these difficult times is understandable. It's structured. It's stable. This new calculation, again, creates instability. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So initially when the governor's budget came out, I think in December, it was estimated to be about $206 million, and I'm seeing in the footnote down here, $184. Is this the new number?
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, correct. And the following slide actually gives some detail on the change from the $206 to the $184.
Mr. Stickel, please continue.
Yeah, so if I may, moving on to slide 30, this addresses that question exactly of why we have changed our statutory appropriation estimate. So with higher oil prices and lower costs, we are estimating about $1.2 billion of increased value for FY19 versus what we were previously forecasting. That works out to about $400 million in increased tax before applying credits at the 35% rate. However, even though the profit increased, we're now using a 10% multiplier instead of a 15% multiplier, and that gets to the $60 threshold in the tax credit statutes that we were discussing earlier. So now that our price forecast has gone from 59 up to, or from the high 50s up to $63, we're now using a 10% multiplier, which is the reason that our statutory appropriation is down a little bit from the fall forecast.
Senator Machicki.
Just curious, Commissioner, if the, and this is related to our liabilities over the next several years. Is the administration pushing the tax credit bonding bill aggressively with the legislature on what the difference would look like on this 184 over the next several years?
So forgive me, through the chair. Clearly that we are pushing. I spend more of my time trying to advance the tax credit bill probably than most other subjects. So it is a priority. It's important. We'd like to see it move forward. We think it makes sense both for the industry, but we think that makes sense for Alaskans because we're in essence, paying for the cost of those bonds through a discount that the producers or the credit holders are willing to accept, and we see it as a win-win. It puts Alaskans back to work, and as has been mentioned before, it also brings additional production online sooner, which will result in additional royalty and tax revenue to the state. I'll say this, and if this isn't exactly responsive, please come back. We have been clear with the credit holders that the forecast that we had in the fall, which was based on 206, would change in the spring, and that change would potentially impact the offer that that we would be making to them under that proposal. So we will need to, now with these new numbers, we'll need to go through and recalculate all that and share that again. We shared with the credit holders the expected discount based on the fall forecast, and we'll give that to them again. I haven't confirmed this with any of them, but I believe they will continue to see a lot of value in that proposal and that offer from industry, and so this forecast doesn't change my interest and the administration's interest in seeing that bill go forward.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As the chairman of the operating budget, can you tell me how would I proceed? Should I continue to follow the governor's path? Do you feel that you're making headway? If you're spending so much time on getting the legislation passed, where do you think you are in convincing the House and the Senate of going down this path?
Through the chair, I'm concerned about the bill. The House has yet to schedule a hearing, and so I can't. Candidly, sitting here today, I can't give you assurance that that bill will pass. If the bill doesn't pass, then it would be the administration's position that the legislature should appropriate then an additional about $145-147 million. We've got $27 million in the budget today that was necessary to cover the interest under that bill, and so it'd be the difference between that and $184 million that would need to be added to the budget.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then, with less than 30 days left in the 90-day session, when do you think you would be able to make some determination as to the success or failure of that legislation passing, so that we can go forward with the budget process? Because if we continue down this path and leave the $27 million as the payment, do you see that as an option? And if it doesn't pass, do you see that coming in as a supplemental next year? Is that the path that you're going forward?
Through the chair, no, my hope would be that in the next a couple of weeks we would have more clarity about that, and then my goal would be to see that the budget is either the full amount, the $184 million, or with the bill passed would be the 27. I think it would be, I believe it would be, again, harmful to industry, harmful to our economy, to delay this decision until a supplemental.
Senator Hoffman.
So for budgetary purposes, I think that the House is scheduled to take action in the immediate future, this week or early next week. It seems as though your time frame is stretching it out a little bit too long from my viewpoint.
Senator Hoffman. Maybe we could take an indication as to whether the House is going to act on that piece of legislation based on the operating budget that they send over. If they send over an operating budget that has $27 million in it, we can expect them to pass something. I would just say, as someone who's been to this rodeo multiple times now, tying pieces of legislation as opportunistic ways to pass other legislation has not been successful in the past. And it's my hope that all legislators will do what's best for Alaska before playing games with particular pieces of legislation. I found it that the Senate will do what's right. We will step up and try to pay our obligations based on what we owe, based on Alaska state statute to the best of our ability. And we look forward to negotiations with the other body and their concerns, because they do have many, and I know that you and I are aware of those concerns that they have. But hopefully we will all work together to do what's right for both those that are investing in Alaska and those who are living in Alaska.
One last one.
Senator Michiki.
Just one last question on the tax credit. It's unlikely that one of the majors would repurchase the credits being above the minimum tax in this price range. Is that correct? Is that an exposure that we believe is largely alleviated with this current price point?
Through the chair, that is largely correct. The majors at this price point, we've assumed in this budget, the majors are paying the tax at the alternative minimum. And the credits will not allow them to actually go below the minimum, and so they don't see value. Generally speaking, they don't see value to purchasing the credits at this time. Mr. Stickle referred to a settlement around this TAPS litigation, and there will be some additional liability on the major's part, somewhere in the neighborhood of $150 million, and so we anticipate that they may buy somewhere between $100 and $125 million of the credits. But we have about $800 million of credits outstanding now, with another couple hundred million dollars that we anticipate will become firm in the next couple of years. And so in the scheme of things, the majors buying $100 million of credits doesn't change the dynamic either for the state or within the industry.
Senator Michiki, followed by Senator Bishop.
Just a brief follow-up. I mean, Madam Chair, you talked about some of the peripheral revenue changes that we've made over the last several years, and that was an effective 115, I believe. Although I don't have a desire to change oil taxes any further at this time, we have made some fairly significant changes in that minimum tax. Happen to be, there are several different ways that the state benefits from that, although it may be somewhat of a hit to the industry that we struggled with. There has been a diversification of revenue that's, some of it's more peripheral than others. Would you agree with that?
Could you, forgive me, through the chair, could you rephrase that question?
Senator Michiki.
Yes, just on the changes we made to not only the Cook Inlet but the North Slope Credit Program and the change to the minimum tax, there are other peripheral revenue advantages that isn't often highlighted by the news or isn't talked about much in the public. But we have made some fairly significant differences that it's often just not realized.
Through the chair, I think that's right. And I guess this is speaking for myself, perhaps more than the administration. I worry about the amount of change that has been happened in this industry, and that it's hard for businesses to plan when there's a high degree of change in the structure.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Bishop, please continue, Commissioner. Mr. Stickle.
Sure. Dan Stickle again for the record. One more slide on tax credits. This is slide 31. This kind of gives a status quo view of how we see the next several years playing out. If the legislature chooses to make the statutory appropriation each fiscal year, and if the bond purchase bill does not end up passing. So in that case, we would estimate about $946 million of tax credits available for state purchase in fiscal year 19 and beyond, Of those, as the commissioner mentioned, we're estimating that $125 million will be purchased by the majors and used to offset some of these TAPS related liabilities for previous calendar years, which leaves a balance of $821 million of credits that we're anticipating would be available for state purchase after those transfers. If the statutory appropriation is made each year, then under this scenario, the balance of credits would be exhausted in fiscal year 2023.
Great. This is Commissioner Fisher again, and I'm going to then go into the revenue forecast specifically, and I'm on slide 33. I'm not going to go through each change.
Could you hold for a moment? Brief at ease. We're back on the record, Commissioner.
Great, thank you.
Senator Bishop.
Yeah, I just want to make one quick comment before we leave off of Dan's last slide of 31. When you go way back, you know, if you go back to slide 4, and I was late, and you look at the production curve and where the world, where the North Slope production is going, and while we have this credit discussion, and everybody knows where I'm at on paying the bills, it's important to remember, I think the sooner we can get our debt paid, the sooner we can keep our production increasing instead of decreasing, because we can talk till we're blue in the face about price. Production is the key to capturing high prices. Thank you.
Senator Bishop, thank you. It also adds 25% royalty at a minimum, if not 33%, to the constitutional, to the corpus of the permanent fund, which will help in Alaska's future to ensure a dividend can be paid under whatever statutory language that we wind up with when we come out of this fiscal situation. So I know that there are folks that may believe that we shouldn't pay our bills if we can't pay a full dividend. But again, I'll only speak for myself in looking at the long haul. The way that we ensure a dividend to the people of Alaska is to ensure that there is money in the earnings reserve account and that the corpus of the permanent fund itself continues to grow and is inflation-proofed over time. And the Senate has passed two different pieces of legislation to try to ensure that the future of the dividend to the people of Alaska, as well as be able to move through paying off these obligations. Thank you, Senator Bishop. Mr. Stickle, please continue. Of course, Commissioner.
Great. So thank you, Madam Chair. This is Commissioner Fisher again. And on slide 33, I don't intend to go through each of these boxes, but this shows you the changes between the spring forecast and the fall forecast in terms of oil price, production, leases, and transportation cost, and then the difference in terms of unrestricted general fund petroleum revenue. Going to slide 34, this is a helpful chart that will allow the legislature or listeners to think about what happens to unrestricted general fund revenues as the price of oil changes. And it's interesting that our forecast is right at an inflection point. And the way I think about that is, for $1 increase, we will receive approximately $75 million of additional revenue. And for a $1 decrease, we will receive about $30 million less. And that really, the reason that this is like this is that at $63, the companies are essentially at their inflection point between their profits tax and the minimum tax, and so it just the math is slightly different. And below that price point, then a change results in about a $30 million change in revenue, and above it, it's about 75.
Thank you for that clarification.
Then moving to slide 36, this shows this revenue forecast between 17, 18, and 19. Again, just kind of staying at a very at high levels, you can see that for the unrestricted general funds have grown by about $1 billion between 17 and 18, and then a much more modest growth. This, again, is not, these are in absolute dollars, not a change from the prior forecast. A big difference is under other revenue, where you can see that our assumptions have declined from 17. That's largely driven by change of investment revenue. The permanent fund had a very strong year in 17 in terms of return. FY18 assumes 8 months of actual returns and then the expected return of 6% for the last 4 months, and then fiscal year 19 is more consistent with the long-range permanent fund assumption of 6.5% return on investment. And then the final slide that we have, slide 37, shows how production, price, and unrestricted general funds have changed from our spring forecast from the fall forecast to the current spring forecast. And so just at a bottom line, you see for FY18, we're predicting a little over $250 million of additional revenue. And then from 19 and beyond, it kind of levels out for a few years closer to $200 million, and then you can see those numbers. But it gives a sense of the additional revenue that will be available for the state. This certainly helps. It certainly is it's going the right direction. Just again, speaking personally, I believe that it will not be enough without other changes to completely address the fiscal challenges the state faces, but it is certainly a meaningful move in the right direction.
Further questions from committee members? Senator Machicki.
I'm fine, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Commissioner, I think that you've stated it well. It is a move in the right direction. Additional revenue, slight decline in production, reduced operating expenses that benefit the transportation charges, along with the lawsuit that Mr. Stickle commented on. So certainly positive news from the last forecast that we received. We have challenging times still ahead in trying to reach agreement with our counterpart in the other body to address Alaska's fiscal challenges, but we do have the means to take care of ourselves should we choose to act. And I think a long time ago, several years ago, the Senate's message was it was time to act. And I think that holds true today, that the sooner we act, the safer and more secure the remaining reserves we have are available to you to produce interest to help close our fiscal gap. Other comments, questions from committee members? Senator Bishop.
Thank you. I apologize for being late this morning, but I just wanted to comment and compliment the administration. I thought this was a very good comprehensive overview.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I would concur. I appreciate the timing of the forecast so that we could use it for consideration. Again, it's a set of variables that we're used to at this table, and understand how those production, price, and expense can change very quickly depending on what's happening in our state. Is there anything else to come before the committee? On Tuesday, we have two items before us, SB 65, Jonesville Public Use Area, and HB 236, Extension of the Senior Benefits Payment Program. With that, we're adjourned.